Right. Well, welcome. It's kind of surprising. I only learned 5 days ago that I was giving the talk, and now I'm suddenly the first speaker. And I'm supposed to talk about the observed properties of this galaxy and give a sort of kind of review. In 5 days, it's clearly impossible to give a complete, fair review of all work going on there. So even an unfair review would be kind of challenging. So mainly concentrate on my own work and collaborators, and pull in the tie-ins with others. And reason, on some kind of other reason, a lot of the things I won't be discussing are discussed later on. So I'll try to avoid with other speakers, and things like dynamics and star formation and things like that, I'll skip all that. But okay, let's see what I will be talking about. So what do we know about local disk galaxies, and what does it mean for galaxy evolution? And I'll concentrate on scaling laws. And scaling laws with things like total luminosity, scale size, surface brightness of galaxies. And with two parts in this talk, first thing I want to determine how many galaxies of disk galaxies do we have locally? There's still so, and what kind of properties do they have? I mean, this ties in with things like Freeman's law, constant central surface brightness of disk galaxies. Is that really true? Things like the bimodal surface brightness distribution that has been proposed by Tully and Verheyen. And is our knowledge of the luminosity function of galaxies complete? Are we missing the low surface brightness galaxies? That's relevant. And how does that relate to galaxy evolution? And second part of the talk is, so what's in these galaxies? And first of all, I wanted to include Dulcis, but Rosie Weiss has just written an excellent review of the Space Telescope conference last year on Dulcis, and so everything I wanted to say is in that, so look it up and read it. And I don't have to discuss it anymore. And so I'll talk about the stellar ages and metallicities of disks and gas metallicity, and how that relates to these scaling laws again. So the first part of the talk. Take a look at the average catalog of galaxies. All galaxies are about the same size, same contrast with the background. Can we turn down the lights a little bit, maybe? I'm not sure who's responsible for that. But thanks. But of course, that's not true. Not all galaxies are the same size and things like that. It's just a selection effect. Galaxy catalogs are heavily biased. And how does this work? Get a pointer here. So there are actually two galaxies in this image, and they're at the same distance. That's the nice big one over here, and there is a little guy that's interacting with it. These two galaxies have the same central surface brightness. It's just that this one has 10 times larger scale size than the other one. And so if you have, for instance, a diameter limited sample, you can put this one 10 times further away before it drops out of the sample, before that one drops out of the sample. 10 times further away is 1,000 times more volume. So this galaxy has 1,000 times more chance of getting in a diameter limited sample than that guy. And therefore, your galaxy samples are going to be heavily biased towards large scale size galaxies, and also actually high surface brightness galaxies. And if you want to correct for that effect, so the visibility, you have to know the distances. I mean, it has been argued that you could, because surface brightness is distance independent, that you could derive surface brightness distribution without knowing distances. That's just not true, because the selection effects that work in a similar way there as well. So that's this diagram that I've borrowed for Stacey McGaugh, this paper with Bolton and Schoenberg. So this is this volume of visibility as function of central surface brightness and scale size, which is very strongly peaked towards high surface brightness, large scale size galaxies. And therefore, your samples will always be dominated for galaxies living up here, high surface brightness scale. And galaxies over here, a certain surface brightness, you don't even detect them because they're below the sky level. So let's look at some data and see how this works. So this is scale size, effective surface brightness, basically, of a sample of about 1,000 spiral galaxies, SB to SDM, so the really late type irregulars are missing here. I-band photometry with redshift, and it's a diameter limited sample. And as you see, most of the galaxies live kind of up here. But there are no galaxies. First of all, there are not that many galaxies up here. And there are no selection effects against these kind of galaxies. I mean, these are big, high surface brightness galaxies. If they existed, they would be there. They're just not there. If you go in this direction, you're getting into the biased region. So, and these lines are sort of typical maximum distances you can see a galaxy with this combination of surface brightness and scale length. So, galaxies along this line, you can see about 20 megaparsecs away, 100 megaparsecs, so this is all for H.065 actually. So, a galaxy living around here has five times less chance, or can be seen five times smaller distance than galaxies around here. So a galaxy over here has 5 cubed, 125 times more chance of getting into your sample than a galaxy around here. So if you correct for that selection effect, so it's basically a Vmax correction, you get the proper number density of galaxies according to these parameters. So, and what you see now, that actually most galaxies are kind of small, and there might be a sort of hint in this direction of lower surface brightness. And for instance, a Malin 1 type of galaxy, a grouching giant living, Malin 1 is almost way off this scale, somewhere over here, is probably extremely rare. I don't think that the universe is dominated by huge low surface brightness galaxies, unless something happens here below my selection limit that I really don't understand. Now, more interesting maybe is not the number of galaxies you have, but the mass contained in them. And the next best thing is, I guess, the amount of starlight. So if you weigh this kind of diagram with the amount of light each galaxy has, you can find which galaxies contribute most of the light through the universe. So that's this diagram. And now we see that most of the light of the galaxies, for this galaxy, is actually coming more in this kind of region, so more higher surface brightness, large scale length. And that's kind of obvious then. They're bigger, right? More light. And most interesting thing is maybe that our galaxy is sort of in this kind of region. Also not completely surprising, if most of the stars are in these kind of galaxies, it's not unlikely that we happen to live near one of these stars. So let's see if we can parameterize this distribution I just showed you. And I'll go back to the sort of most favorite moment of the model of the moment, the CDM-like universe hierarchical galaxy formation. And so that gives you rise to a Schechter theory, and that was sort of inspiration for the Schechter luminosity function. So the luminosity distribution of these galaxies I'll describe as a Schechter luminosity function. Then now you want to have the second dimension, right? You have the luminosity, surface brightness, scale length. If you don't know two of these parameters, you have the third one. So what determines the scale size or the surface brightness of a galaxy? And in this kind of theory that was pioneered by Fall and Astafiou, it's the angular momentum of the system that determines the scale size of the galaxy. And these angular momenta is acquired from tidal torques during the expansion of the universe. And actually most of the tidal torque is during the turnaround moment. And that gives rise to, if you look in n-body simulations of dark matter halos in an expanding universe, the angular momentum spin distribution is a log normal distribution, and it's very stable and independent of cosmology or environment, the density of the environment, or things like that. So if you use that spin parameter for describing, and this is how you get the spin parameter for a dark matter halo, if you assume that gas is having the same kind of angular momentum in these dark matter halos and settles in a flat rotation curve disk, exponential disk, and the specific angular momentum is conserved in detail, using Virial theorem and light traces mass telefissure, you can convert this spin parameter in observable parameters like scale size. So here are some of the parameters go in there, but that's not really the important conclusion, is that the spin parameter in this very simple minded fashion is proportional to the scale size and a luminosity at a given luminosity. Right? So, and as the spin parameter has an log normal distribution, you expect also that the scale size has a log normal distribution at a given luminosity. And where the peak in the log normal distribution is shifts with about L minus 1/3 power. So let's have a look at this distribution as I determined it from the local galaxies and compare that to this kind of simple model. I hope you can see this. I have here different bins of luminosity, and look, the blue histogram gives you the distribution of scale sizes in each from high luminosity to low luminosity systems. And on top of that, the red dotted line there is this log normal distribution at a given luminosity and giving a shift. And the height of this distribution is to check the luminosity function. And as you can see, it's a pretty good fit to the data. This very simple-minded model, without any bells or whistles, can describe the scale size luminosity distribution of local group the galaxies in the local environment. The error bars are the 95% confidence levels, and the upper arrows are non-detection. I haven't got galaxies in that sample, but I can calculate the 95 confidence limits that I should have seen them, right? So these are just for a given exponential disk. So indeed, there might be huge galaxies out here. Well, no, these are small galaxies. I mean, huge galaxies, but they're going to be very rare. These upper limits are. Now, of course, this was a very simple-minded model, but it's a good way of to parameterize this kind of distribution, and which would be very handy if you want to compare different kind of redshifts. No. This is all both the model and the data. I mean, this is not independent measurements. It's just the whole two-dimensional. This is just a projection of a two-dimensional thing. I can't display it differently. I wish I had a three-dimensional projector. We would all love that, I guess. Now, this was the simple kind of version. If you now go to the kind of semi-analytic modeling that has become very popular recent decade, I guess. I think I forgot to mention. The width of this distribution is almost a factor too narrow in this simple-minded model than what you would expect from n-body simulations. The spin distribution would predict that this is much broader. And if you go to do more complicated model and semi-analytic modeling, and I'm using here the models of the Durham group, as published in Cole et al. Soon. And so this is again the same distribution. Now I'm plotting only the scale length of the disk. The other one was of the total galaxy. And compare that to these kind of models where they include much more physics of gas dynamics and heating and cooling and merging histories of the. Then you still see that this distribution is broader than what you would expect. And so what is it? Why is the observed distribution narrower than what you would expect from the spin distribution? Well, as I said, the spin distribution is not that much in doubt. Any n-body simulation gets very similar results, so it's quite broad. So what we need is some way of destroying these kind of disks, or these kind of disks, or both, because these models can shift about a little bit. We could do that, for instance, the low angular momentum system, so the high surface brightness, small scale length galaxies, become dynamically unstable and transform in spheroidal systems, and that way destroy galaxies around this side. Or no detailed angular momentum conservation, so that, for instance, these galaxies are collapsing further than you would expect because the feedback is not as efficient as on this side. Would be a bit. Or what we know, that the scale length of the stars is not the same as the scale length of the gas, which is most of the time assumed in these kind of models. So if there is a selectively smaller scale size of this compared to the gas on this side and on that side, then you can make the distribution also narrower. But, I mean, that's still an open question there. So now, if you want to know how this kind of distribution affect your determination of luminosity function, right? You basically, luminosity function is an integration of this two-dimensional distribution. If you cut out the you set your surface brightness limits at 20 Eyman magnitude per arc second square, then you're going to be affected at the low surface brightness and quite severely. It's just that this, well, this is about 22 MB. That's not a practical limit for a local survey. And you're probably, even for photographic plates, you're going to be quite complete to quite low luminosity systems. This is, of course, not true if you're going to higher redshift, where surface brightness dimming is coming in. And you really have to take into account that you're going to miss galaxies around here, just because they're low surface brightness. So now, something else of interest, what is really the surface brightness distribution? So that's the projection in the other direction. And if you could go to the really tiny galaxies, this distribution is rather flat. So there are quite a lot of low surface brightness galaxies out there, but they're very low luminosity. So if you want to know where most of the light is coming from in the universe as function of surface brightness, then that's a very, very strong peaked function. And if you say at 22 or something like that in I, 24 in B, you've got most of the luminosity in the universe already. And you don't have to worry too much about low surface brightness galaxies. There is a lot of luminosity there. Okay, so that's the first part of the talk. What do we know about how many galaxies we have? Let's go to the second part. What's in there and how does it relate to these kind of structural parameters? So the basic question is, what drives star formation history in galaxies, and what is the chemical evolution of these galaxies? And how is it related to the structural parameters? Are the spirals just determined by the initial conditions? Do you have a bunch of gas and that's it? Or do you need something else like inflow of gas or outflow, it looks like we need for the Milky Way. So, first of all, we have to find a method to measure stellar ages and metallicities. I mean, gas metallicities measurements are quite straightforward, but that's only, of course, the current kind of metallicity. We don't know anything about the history. So you could use absorption line indices, but that's for this galaxy, it's more problematic. Because they have lower surface brightness, and this method is mostly used on ellipticals and bulges, maybe. And gas emission fills in the absorption lines that you need, so that's also making it tricky. So I'll go to show you a method of using broadband photometry. Now, broadband photometry has always been claimed that it's impossible to break the degeneracy in age and metallicity, but I'll show you that with near IR photometry, you might be able to get some handle on it. I'm not saying that you get complete answer, but get some handle on it. And of course, you get with imaging, you get the whole galaxy, and you can reach much fainter levels than with spectroscopy. But you have to worry about dust rattling, and I'll come to that as well. So let's first have a look at how this works. If you look at the color diagram in U minus B, B minus V, if you plot the, in this case, Brugel and Chalot models, let's first have a look at B minus R, J minus K plotted here. So you have an optical color, and you can use here an optical infrared or an infrared works even better. The yellow horizontal kind of lines are models of equal metallicity. And in this direction, I'm plotting for the red lines different models of different star formation histories. On the right hand side, you get basically a single burst and evolve it for 12 giga-years and see what kind of colors you get. On the left-hand side, you have a sort of constant star formation rate. And you get this kind of colors over here. And in between, you have exponential declining star formation rate. Now, this, of course, exponential declining star formation rate is not really realistic, but what this kind of diagram basically models measures is the relative amount of young stars versus the amount of old stars. So it's sort of how much stars are typically younger than, say, 2 giga-years relative to the amount of stars older than 4 giga-years. And that's basically what going on in this kind of direction, and that kind of direction, and it's all luminosity wavelengths. Okay, if you try to do that with optical colors, of course this is completely degenerate, and there's no way you can separate age and metallicity. Let's have a look at some data. So this is the model grid underneath again, and we have collected for 120 galaxies about from high to low surface brightness, large to small data, and I'm plotting here from in the radial direction what the color gradient is within the galaxies. So and red part of the galaxy is in general the center, and then it becomes bluer outward. And you see there is a sort of nice sequence here, even though there is some kind of real spread. But at the faint, at the very young, these are the blue ones are the low surface brightness galaxy. There is kind of more of a spread at a given given age. There is quite a spread in metallicity. Now we're using a maximum likelihood technique to attach these models to the data so that you get a parameterization of age and metallicity using all passbands. So this is only three of the available six passbands we have for most of this data. And now if you look at a certain radius, at a certain surface brightness of a galaxy, what kind of ages and metallicities you have, you see a strong trend here. So surface brightness apparently is determining very much what the typical age is in a population and what the typical metallicity is. And the color coding is actually here total luminosity of the systems. And here you don't see much segregation, but typically there are bluer, low surface brightness galaxies tend to be a bit lower metallicity at a given surface brightness. So low surface brightness means already lower metallicity, but if they're low luminosity, they're even lower metallicity. And the red ones, higher luminosities are higher metallicity. So let's have a quick look at that. So if you plot the typical age at the effective radius as function of surface brightness and as function of luminosity, in both cases you see a trend. And so you wonder what's this determining now the typical age of a population. Is it surface brightness or luminosity? Problem is, these things are of course correlated, and so how do you separate them? Let's have a look at the diagram again. Now if you take out this slope in this diagram and correlate the residuals on that slope with the other parameters, so taking out the slope with surface brightness and correlate that with luminosity and see what's left, there's very little of a trend left. So basically, with surface brightness, you can determine already what kind of typical ages you get in a population. If you do it the other way around, taking out the luminosity trend, then there is still something left with surface brightness. So surface brightness is enough to describe the typical age of a stellar population at that surface brightness. If you do it the other way, for metallicities, you do the same trick, take the trend out and correlate it with still something left. If you take the luminosity trend out, there's still a trend left with surface brightness. So metallicity, you need both. You can't separate, say, okay, surface brightness is determining completely the metallicity, or so ages are determined by the local surface brightness, while the metallicity has a component that is determined by surface brightness and by the total luminosity of the system. There are some caveats here. I won't go into details of these 2 points, the IMF and the stellar population. It's just robust against that. Reddening, I will go through very quickly because I'm running out of time. Reddening will mainly affect kind of the metallicity trends, because reddening factors are sort of parallel to the metallicity factor in these diagrams, in the color diagrams. But I don't think it's going to be affecting us too much, because galaxies we're using our phase on. We know sort of limits from these kind of situations where you can see the background galaxy, so you can set limits on the amount of reddening there and typical galaxies. We see no dependence with inclination. Colors are mainly determined by the least obscured star, so if you have a completely opaque disk in the middle, you still see the same colors, because the stars you don't see don't contribute to the color. And the same is true for patchy dust. And redding is mainly caused by absorption. If you want to know about that, I'll explain it in more detail. But anyway, I think that the relative rankings I gave you for ages and metallicities are quite robust. It's just the absolute ages and metallicities we don't know. So let's try to do some simple modeling here. First of all, the simple closed box model we all know. Start with an exponential gas disk and have star formation according to the surface density of the gas. Instantaneous recycling, and just determine the same way ages and metallicities again. We can add bells and whistles, like because we need this total luminosity dependence in changing the metallicity. We need something that determines changes things there. So first, again, first the surface brightness, typical age, typical metallicity, and a closed box model gives you a quite pretty good fit there. It's just that we don't have the mass dependence in the metallicity yet. So if you have a mass dependent infall model, actually most of the things that will change is age, and that's exactly not what we want. We want the metallicity to depend on the mass of the galaxy. So that works much better if you blow out your enriched gas dependent on the mass of the galaxy, so the potential well of the galaxy. Other models, dynamical timescale model, where the outer parts have lowest, it's actually working the wrong way around. You have a metal luminosity dependence there, but it's not the way you want it. Finally, you can have very late star formation. You start just forming your galaxies much later, and then that way you can also introduce a mass dependence, but you get too much mass dependence there in the typical age. I'll skip the, because I'm running out of time, the comparison of these models with gas metallicities, but ask about that if you want to know it. So, to round things up, surface brightness and scale size of galaxies show a log normal distribution as a function of luminosity of a galaxy. But the width is narrower than you would expect from n-body simulations in the hierarchical galaxy formation scenario. If you know the local surface brightness in a galaxy, you can sort of get a handle on the typical star formation history. But if you want to know the metallicity there, you need also a total luminosity component. And a mass-dependent outflow of enriched gas helps you to explain most of the parameters in these kind of simple still models. Thank you. Well, you can always combine I separated now the different models there. But you can offset one model versus the effect of another model. And so the combined effects will still fit. This was just to show what kind of parameters. Yeah, I guess that's the main ingredient, that you need some kind of outflow. Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Are the dwarf spheroidal, right? This is all about disk galaxies. No, we have some of these galaxies were observed at the South Pole because they're so extremely low surface brightness and small scale size that in K-band you wouldn't be able to do it anywhere else. So we have this huge range of surface brightness and huge range of luminosity. And that's why we can investigate these kind of trends. Well, it's in the data, yeah, exactly. I mean, our sample is just this galaxies. And so I won't make any claims about other type of galaxies. Okay.